Spring Black Friday savings are happening now at the Home Depot and also at your front door. Get spring savings delivered to you with free delivery on over 2 million items. Everything you need for spring cleaning, patio decorating, and front yard gardening sent right to you. And if you need it fast, get same-day delivery on thousands of products like fertilizer and seeds to keep your yard looking beautiful. Spring your way with Spring Black Friday savings only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Order select in-stock items by 4 p.m. subject to availability.
Well, welcome to the first Brandel Chambly podcast with Jaime Diaz, myself here. And it's a real honor to be with Brandel, a great privilege to work with him. I've always admired him from afar as a player and certainly as a commentator and an analyst. I think he breaks new ground so often, and that's why he's here. And Brandel?
Right back at you.
No, buddy.
You know, yeah. I've been reading you since, well, I don't even know. It's probably since I was in college. So. You know, a lot of my friends in golf, some of my best friends, were writers.
Yeah.
Because I've just picked up so much from you gentlemen and women over the years.
Well, you're a writer yourself.
It's a pleasure. Well,
with one book to your name and one coming up.
I put stuff on paper and then it goes to the computer, but I'm hardly a writer. But anyway, it's a pleasure. Look forward to it.
It's a great pleasure. Today we're going to talk about Tiger and Jack a little later, which is a huge topic. It could go a lot of different ways. Brandel's talked about those two guys in very, very groundbreaking and interesting ways, and I've certainly covered a lot of both of them, and it's always been a privilege. They're a rich topic, so we're looking forward to that. But the main thing the thing that we're going to talk to at the beginning of these podcasts is something current, and there's been a lot of things happening in golf in the first half of the year. Right now, Justin Rose, the number one player in the world, is switching golf clubs from TaylorMade to Hamna, at least got a 10-club contract. There's a way of thinking now that perhaps the companies and the technology has gotten so sophisticated that changes are not that dangerous because anything the player wants can be replicated exactly to his eye and exactly to his specs, and it's not a big transformation. But as you know, the history of golf is full of mishaps when equipment has been changed, and I wonder how you're looking at this.
Yeah, I've heard that for years, that the precision is such in equipment that changes can be made seamlessly. I've yet to see it happen. I think the two most dangerous places on the PGA Tour are the driving range. It's a very dangerous place. And equipment trucks. I mean, you can get some great work done in there, no question about it. And from a repair aspect, it's irreplaceable out there. But when you see somebody make a change so quickly and such a wholesale change, I mean, if you remember, it took Tiger Woods a long time to make changes back in the early 2000s. It took him a long time, almost, more than a year to make changes through the bag. So I was curious just how Justin Rose would start this year. And, starting in the desert, his ball striking statistics were way down. He was near the bottom of the field, and strokes gained tee to green, he was near the bottom of the field. Now around the green, he was still brilliant, and on the green, he was still brilliant.
But that was a red flag to you.
I think look, it's one event, so the statistical sample is really, really small.
Yeah.
But if you go back to 2018, the last three, four events he played, he had come to a point in his career. Really, it was a crescendo. It was building. You're talking about 20 years of work. Tedious work to his golf swing, to his body, to finally put the final pieces of the puzzle together to his putter, which is why he became the best player in the world. It was the one thing that was missing. And he finally gets there, and then he changes equipment. So certainly something to look forward to, or not look forward to, but watch out for as this year goes on. And one event under his belt, from a ball striking standpoint, it was one of the worst performances he's had in a long time.
And just to follow up, going back and drawing from your own career, all through your career, when you made an equipment change, can you describe the nuanced differences that could entail?
Look, I would go into an equipment trailer with a driver and say, look, I need a backup. And they'd make 20 of them, 25 of them. And then I'd go out to the range with those 25 identical drivers. The club head were presumably the same weight, the shafts were the same weight, same grips on them, and none of them would be identical. None of them. They would all be different,
And they're different to you guys because you have the feel and the touch that's very precise.
Right. I used to joke that it was akin to finding a good partner in life. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like you can have all these criteria,
yeah,
but in the end, I mean, there's some luck involved. And
the more you notice and the more details you notice, not just about a person, but about a golf club, the more likely that it won't fit you exactly as your previous
one. Yeah, well, I'll give you one. I just recently, in the off season, I'm going to call it our off season. We had a couple weeks off here. I started messing around with equipment. You know, I'm going to try to play some this next year a little bit. And I went and got fitted for a driver and a 3-wood. And, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to find the exact flight, the exact spin rate, the exact apex, the exact landing angle, all that. And then, and mind you, I'm playing a driver that's 15 years old. So,
when I showed up,
well, they said I needed a new driver. And I said, you're not going to beat this one. You won't make one better than this. And indeed, even when I was being tested, they could only find a driver that would go like a mile or two miles an hour faster with ball speed. So I said, there's a reason I'm playing this driver. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not playing it for its looks because God knows it's ugly. Anyway, we find one that has all the right specs. They send me one that they make identical to that.
Mm-hmm.
And in no way, shape, or form was it identical.
Yeah.
None. I took it with me to a golf soiree, and it got out there and it fluttered at its apex and it came down at a different angle. And these are people that know what they're doing. And I'm not criticizing them. I'm just saying there is a lot of nuance and a lot of luck to finding the right equipment. Now, Justin would have access to constant, you know, analysis, forensic study of launch angles, spin rate. You got TrackMan and FlightScope with him and all those things every shot he hits. But it still boils down to feel here, knowing the personality of a club, knowing what it's going to do when you want to hit this shot in that situation. And it was just surprising to me.
Okay.
It was just surprising to me. Well, I can't imagine why someone would make a change in equipment for money. For money.
Well, he would say it's mostly for aesthetics. But let's put a pin in that, and we'll just keep our eye on it because we're going to need a bigger sample size. But
we'll need a bigger sample size.
And, you know, okay, now, of course, Tiger Woods is starting 2019 here. And 2018 was an incredible success relative to where he started from.
Greatest comeback in the history of golf, in my opinion.
Now, in a sense, the expectations have been raised. And I just wonder where you think he is, and what do you see for this year?
Well, if he comes back and drives the ball anywhere near like he did at the Tour Championship last year, then everything's possible. You know, it's possible that he'll break Sam Snead's record of 82 wins this year. He's only going to win 3 more times to do that. That's very possible. It's possible that he could win a major championship. It's much more likely that that was a bit of an anomaly. It was a perfect week for him. You know, if you look at, you know, from the time he turned pro until 2010. He was, you know, year in and year out, if you take all those averages, he was right around fifth or sixth in driving distance with a fair amount of accuracy. And even beyond that, his miss wasn't that bad. Mm-hmm. Distance from the edge of the fairway is a very important statistic because it just tells you how bad his bad swing is.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, he's been closer to 50th on average in driving distance. And then this includes last year, closer to 50th in driving distance. But so he had his worst year ever last year in distance from the edge of the fairway. He's 165th, I believe. So you're talking about he's driving it worse than he ever has, even though he drove it beautifully at the Tour Championship.
And crookeder.
It's more likely, and look, he's 43, he's not 42, and the door closes so fast. So he's more likely going to struggle with his driving in a way that he never has before. And even though he putted fine, he didn't putt brilliantly. You couldn't say that nobody putted better than him. Right. Scores of people putted better than him. So it's more likely that he's going to struggle with his putting to some extent like he never has before. It's more likely that he's going to struggle with his driving to some extent that he never has before. Now, he still remains almost peerless with his iron play. He finished third in strokes gained approach. Now, that's off for him. Every year that he's been measured since 2006, he has been the very best iron player. And that, people are always like, what's the secret to winning? You know, the secret, if you want to call it a secret, is separating yourself with great iron shots, period. That's it. Now, there's you fill in the blanks from there, but it all starts with great iron play. And he was you know, head and shoulders above everybody else. Last year he was third, so he's still marvelous. So, you know, we'll hang on every shot he hits. We'll watch every shot he hits because he's got a chance now to get back on the trajectory, career trajectory path to be the greatest player of all time.
Right.
And his game's fallen off in the last decade. You know, off of that trajectory quite a bit. He was on pace to be the greatest player of all time. And we're talking about two different things. He played the greatest golf that's ever been played. If we're talking about a peak season, 5 years, peak. Nobody ever played golf like Tiger Woods did from, say, 98 to 2002. Nobody. It's not even close. By far and away. But nor has anybody dominated for as long as Jack Nicklaus. It's not even close. Now, Tiger was on a path to catch Jack and surpass Jack, but he's fallen off substantially. He's got a chance to pick back up.
Well,
where
you segued into our main topic very seamlessly. Thank you. I did just want to add really quickly, do you put any stock in the idea that Tiger was building last year towards something greater and that he's actually on an upward trajectory so that his bad shots and those statistics were skewed by the beginning as opposed to where he was by the time the Tour Championship was played? I know he played poorly at the Ryder Cup and didn't play well in the match, but do you feel like he is at a higher level?
That's a good question.
Because of the last part of the year than perhaps his stats would indicate?
That's a good question. I would say Tiger's always had an assembly period in the 4 or 5 times that he's made changes. It's taken him a while to assemble the parts of the swing that he needed to, and you could watch him do it last year, and he did it beautifully. From Genesis to Honda, it was a completely different move. Much, much longer swing, more, a little quieter in transition. And then even at the Tour Championship, and towards the end of the year, he wasn't swinging as violent as he was. So, yeah, I think there was some assembly. The problem is he's not 28 doing this. Mm-hmm. He's not even 32 doing this. He's 43. So there's such a physiological decline at 42, 43. You start to look at the top 10 players, the greatest players of all time, and you want to look at how many times they won and how many majors they won. Oh. It's a dearth of success.
Only Sam and Vijay and a couple.
Right. Now, when you want to throw out Sam and Vijay and Julius Burrows, these are great examples. But they had long, languid golf swings. Nobody's going to ever call Tiger Woods' golf swing long and languid. And for the most part, Julius Burrows, Vijay Singh, and Sam Snead were injury-free throughout their careers. And there's another aspect of this that I don't think people put enough emphasis on. When you live in the domain, when you breathe the air of constant scrutiny to the extent that Tiger Woods has, and I would say Jack Nicklaus did to a relative extent in his era, Arnold Palmer did, Greg Norman did, those players, there's a psychic...
You wear out faster.
There's a psychic cost. Mm-hmm. They have advantages over us, but there's also disadvantages. Being under the scrutiny to that extent, at some point, you have to say, you know what, I'm happier, in Tiger's case, spearfishing and freediving or whatever it is. Paternal pangs certainly come into the play. And that has, I think, as much as anything to do with the dearth of success post 43, and that really is beginning to be the cutoff at great success on the PGA Tour when you look at players. So, I'm like everybody else. I love watching Tiger Woods play golf. He's captivating, and he's on the cusp of doing things that maybe will never be bettered in the history of the game. But I'm not as optimistic about his chances of doing it.
And to go back to your earlier point about the psychic cost, wasn't Jack maybe the best? Obviously, he was the greatest player in terms of career. But wasn't part of that greatness the way he could manage his life?
No question.
And that he had an intuitive sense or a planned sense. I think it was more intuitive that this was the time to back off. And this was the time to recover and rest and not play at the end of the year.
No question.
He had a great line. I recall him. I was lucky. It was just to me. It was like, you have to keep your juice. You have to know what you have, how much you have, and how do you keep it? And that's really the career challenge. And I think, to his frame of mind, that's why attributable to a lot of his greatness. So
I couldn't agree more.
As we talk about Tiger and Jack, there's so many variables and there's so many ways to compare them. You have said that, and I think it's a commonly held view, that Tiger played the greatest golf ever. Jack had the greatest career. So how would you break that down as far as who was actually greater?
Yeah, well, I'm of the opinion that you take your opinions out once or twice a month, and you beat them up, you kick them around, and you look for the holes, and I'm always after a better way to talk about what Tiger has been to golf, and what Jack and what Walter Hagen and Sam Snead and Annika Sorenstam and Patty Berg were to the game of golf. And recently I came across a book that I thought was just absolutely fascinating. And generally it takes somebody outside of golf to look at golf mm-hmm. in a way that typically people inside golf don't look at it. And this fellow is a man by the name of Bill Felber, who does a lot of saber statistics for baseball.
The book's called The Whole Truth.
The Whole Truth, much mm-hmm. the same way that Bill James does. Mm-hmm. Statistic analysis for baseball. And he used a system. Look, if you can assemble scores, if they assemble in a bell curve, essentially, and everybody's familiar with what a bell curve looks like.
Most people.
Right.
And then I would be challenged.
Right. Yeah. And most people know what a bell, it literally looks like a bell.
Right.
And if you have a bell, then one standard deviation will be 65% of the scores mm-hmm. in a tournament. Two standard deviations will be 95 of those scores, and 99% of the scores will be represented within three standard deviations. And so you then use that standard deviation to convert to what he calls a Z-score and essentially assign a number to success on the PGA Tour, which is a complicated way of saying every tournament mm-hmm. counts.
Yeah.
So in golf, I've been in these discussions forever, and people will say, well, Jack had 18 wins, Tiger's got 14 wins, Jack was better. Mm-hmm. And they'll use that type of reason and rationale.
Majors have become the shorthand.
The shorthand.
For measuring, yeah.
But to only consider wins, Jack won 10% of his golf tournaments, so we're going to dismiss 90% of them? Mm-hmm. This would be like judging a quarterback for the last 5 minutes in the fourth quarter mm-hmm. across all quarterbacks.
Yeah.
We're only going to talk about 5 minutes in the fourth quarter. It's like, no, all the golf counts. And that's where Jack begins to become even greater in our eyes. Like mm-hmm. he is so far past the golfer that Tiger Woods has been in his career, and the golfer that even Walter Hagen was and Sam Snead was. He's got such a lead mm-hmm. career-wise because, yes, Tiger was more dominant in a short period of time, 98 to 2002, than Jack ever was. Mm-hmm. But Jack did have two marvelous peaks in the 90s and the 70s. But Jack has been dominant far more, far longer than any golfer.
But don't we look at sports, I mean, whether it's Mickey Mantle, for example, who had a pretty small window, and at the same time, a lot of people consider him the greatest player they ever saw. Or the player who was great for
yes.
over time,
yes.
For a long
yeah.
time.
Well, look, great question. Go ahead.
No.
I was just
going to
say, great question. Mm-hmm. But in other sports, you don't get the longevity. You know, you get a very short window of athleticism. And once there's physiological decline, they're done. So you can more aptly say whoever was the best, plain and simple. Mm-hmm. But in golf, I think you have to ask two questions because careers span from the time you turn pro really until you turn 50. They're playing competitive golf. Mm-hmm. Okay, Sam Snead finished sixth in the Open Championship in 1962. Sixth. He was 50. Mm-hmm. Harry Vardon finished second in the Open in 1920. He was 50.
I still think it's a new way to look at things.
So it is. Yeah. So, you have to talk about Tiger's not going to quit playing competitive golf unless injury resigns him, to the sidelines.
But we remember Bobby Jones for 1930, and we remember Ben
yeah.
Hogan for 1953, and we remember
right.
Tiger for 2000. And
right.
Jack, it's hard to figure 1 year, which is part of his greatness, maybe 72 or 75. Everybody remembers 86 as the great climax, but
yeah.
that wasn't he wasn't the greatest golfer at that moment. So I'd like to ask you in a different way, because I think you make an excellent point, and I think it's understandable. Regardless, I mean, The Whole Truth is a wonderful book as far as breaking it down in numbers, and I have no reason to think it's not accurate. But it comes from a perspective that says we're counting every shot. And I don't think in most people's mind, as they evaluate golfers, they're counting every shot.
No,
because
they're not.
Because some people's bad golf is really bad. Walter Hagen's, the end of his golf career, I would imagine, was pretty bad. Although he did last for a tremendous amount of time.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't judge Houston as the only example, except that, he was basically a ceremonial golfer there for about 4 or 5 years. Probably didn't play enough tournaments to affect the greater whole.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So I wonder, is it more genuine to people or authentic to people to look at a player in terms of how complete he was and what were his tools
but that is where you start to consider every tournament, because the complete player, it has to do with every facet of his game. It also has to do with the fluidity and the rhythm of his golf swing, which would prohibit you or make you less susceptible to injuries, the balance in your life.
Well, you're talking about management.
Yeah, you're talking about management,
and,
career
and
management.
And Jack was the greatest manager. I don't think there's any doubt. I happen to think Jack was the greatest player.
But beyond that, but Jack had a golf swing that was less injurious to
the
body.
I understand.
So if you pick the ball off the turf, you're going to do less injury to your body than people who have...
It's almost like Tiger, you know, self-destructed in a almost out of his duty towards ultimate improvement.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. So I have said before, and I'll continue to say this, that Tiger got the least out of his talent of any golfer in history.
Well, but that's across longevity.
No,
you make the argument that he himself wanted to be and believed he was an overachiever?
No.
That's what he believed.
Well, I mean, it's
because
fine.
He thought he was
quite talented, yeah,
but that he outworked people.
Yeah. Well, every great player outworked every. I mean, look, you know, Jack Grout would say nobody worked harder than Jack Nicklaus. Ben Hogan worked harder than anybody else. People will say Tiger Woods outworked you. Greg Norman is the hardest worker
all
ever.
Working.
Gary Player is the
you
hardest.
You think it's a given that
Annika Sorenstam is the hardest worker ever. They all work hard, but everybody's going to say, and people around them in their camp are going to say nobody worked harder than
them. Well, Tiger thought it was manifested very quickly just to say that he felt like if he had a weakness, he could make it a strength.
Well,
the game, that's not very common.
And that was, you could say, his greatest strength, but his greatest weakness. So when I say he got the least out of his talent, I come at it from this perspective. From the 97 Masters to the 2009 PGA where Y.A. Yang beat him. The 97 Masters where he won by 12. That's 50 majors that he played in. And he won 14 of them. That's 28%.
Yeah.
Okay. Since the 2010 Masters to the 2019 PGA, that's 24 majors that he's played in. He's won zero of those, okay? That's zero. So 28% of 24 is roughly seven majors, okay? Now, let's set that aside for a minute. He willfully abandoned the golf swing that won by 12 in 97, okay? He went on a 10-major winless streak and then came back with a new swing. From 99 to 2010, that's 16 major championships, and he won seven of those. Seven of 16 is 43%. Okay. Then he willfully abandoned that golf swing. He came back in the 2005 Masters. So 2005 Masters, 2009 PGA, he played in 18 major championships, and he won six of them. That's 33%. Take your pick, 33%. Mm-hmm. So let's split the difference, call it 38%. If you consider what 38% is of the 10 majors he missed in 97 and the 10 majors he missed when he decided to change his golf swing in 2002 to 2005, again, that's close to seven more majors. And the only reason I say this about Tiger Woods is he is from a statistical probability and prediction standpoint, he was the most analyst friendly. You could hang your hat on predictions with him. And statistical probabilities are a real thing. I mean, the likelihood that they're going to happen in any one event is highly unlikely, but over the course of time, they're going to happen. So you're talking about 14 major championships. Who else out there had the potential to win 14 major championships, and just because they decided to change their golf swing, for no other reason.
Well, go ahead.
He did not win them.
I understand.
And more than that, those lapses are why he lapsed behind Jack Nicklaus.
Mm-hmm.
So Jack Nicklaus, in the entire decade of the 70s, finished outside the top 10 five times. Think about that, just five times. Conversely, Tiger Woods from 2000 to 2009 finished outside the top 10 13 times. And from 2010 to present, he finished outside the top 10 16 times. And even in 97 to 2009, five times he finished outside the top 10. So that incessant addiction to build and destroy cost Tiger Woods in the comparison with Jack Nicklaus. Now, you could, and he probably does, make the argument that they're the reason he played the greatest golf ever. I'd say that the swing that won by 12 shots in 97 was good enough to win at a 33-43% clip.
And I've talked to a lot of players who, Gary Player, Lee Trevino in particular, those two guys felt like Tiger sort of outsmarted himself. He tried to go for something that probably was not a wise thing in terms of the realities of golf, which is, you know, it's better to maintain and then understand that the game is actually a game of constant adjustment every day anyway. You don't really have the same swing every day, even if you're using the same swing thought. You think you do. So
that's right.
His idea was, I can overpower the precedent here because I'm that talented and I have that much will.
That's right.
And I think so. That sense of greatness that he had was something that fueled him towards greatness, perhaps it had this backlash that you're talking about. I would say I think you're putting maybe too much emphasis on the golf swing when you're talking about post-2010, because there were psychological factors.
Oh, no question.
And a lot of things.
But that's balance in life. It's not just
golf
swing.
Okay, I got you there.
But it was also...
But when you say willfully change the golf swing, you know, that's a pejorative, willfully. It sounds to me like you're saying, you know, he did something that almost maybe subconsciously was self-destructive.
Well, I'm just saying injury did not make him change his golf swing in 2000 or 2002. It didn't make him change his golf swing in 97. And even the change that he made in 2010, it was such a drastic change. It went beyond just the swing changes.
Sure, but he was at a point at that time when he was rebuilding everything.
Oh, no question.
I mean,
you're talking about career.
I mean, he went to Sean Foley, and, you know, Sean had some radical ideas. The golf swing conception out on tour was changing. There was a lot of hanging left, sort of stack and tilt concepts.
But that golf swing was so bad for him.
I'm sure it was, Brandel. I'm not questioning you. You'd be the judge of the good golf swings. But I just wonder about his judgment and whether we should castigate him for seeking something, because he'd always been a seeker.
I'm not castigating.
Oh, no, but I'm just saying, when you say he's the most underachieving golf coach.
Let's just say, I'll use another example. Let's say that Shakespeare in 1599 quit writing, okay? Now, in 1599, he wrote Hamlet, okay? Yeah. Prior to that, he had written Romeo and Juliet. He'd written Julius Caesar. He'd written Henry V, Much Ado About Nothing. And he'd written basically half of this body of work. If he had quit writing right then, we wouldn't have King Lear, we wouldn't have Macbeth, we wouldn't have Henry VIII, and scores of other, the other half of his writing. Now, if somebody said, you have the talent to write King Lear and Macbeth and Henry VIII, and you don't write it, okay, you don't write it, it is underachieving on an unbelievable scale.
But you're underestimating the mystery of art and the mystery of talent and the mystery of genius. No one, even the genius, doesn't know what's ahead.
No question about
it. So he made this call, you've judged it, and with facts and with, you know, some justification that it was a mistake. And maybe Tiger at some point in his career or his life will look back and go, you know, I flew too close to the sun there.
But look, he's just trying to get back to the golf swing he had in 2000. I think he's basically admitted.
Now, perhaps. But there was certainly a period where he thought that golf swing was flawed. And to your point, 2007 was as good as 2000.
It was.
And that was a different golf swing.
It was.
I mean, I think the view
from
most players is, when you're that talented, it's scary what a teacher tells you because you can do it.
I'm not saying that the golf swing that he had in 2007 was worse than the swing he had in 2000.
But
not
the,
at all.
The change is what cost him.
All an athlete has is
time. Yes.
And the cost, not only the actual time cost, I'm talking about the psychological drain of it.
Yeah.
It is distracting in so many different ways. And you're right, there's huge psychological, emotional detriments, hurdles that he had to get over from 2010. But again, that goes to the balance. That's why we talk about Jack Nicklaus as the greatest player of all time, is because he had that balance in his life. And he had that self-discipline. And that matters over a career.
Let me shift gears slightly to Jack, because my opinion, Jack, yes, all those intangibles, management and patience and temperament, are in his favor, I think, in most people's mind as being exceptional and being the keys to his greatness. But I sometimes think, and I didn't see him play a lot, but I was fortunate in 70s to see him some. But I think he's underestimated in terms of how good he was physically. Because I think there's a presumption that Tiger was the superior athlete and could do more with speed. I think Tiger's advantage was the short game and putting, and you're probably in agreement as far as short game over Jack.
Putting necessarily.
Okay, let's around the green.
But even I would disagree with you because it's wrong to say that Tiger was a great pitcher, chipper of the ball. Great, it's wrong. It's just not represented in any way. He was a little bit above, he was above average. But you see those chips and you think, God, he's the greatest chipper of all time.
Well, because they were achieved in the moment
when it had to be done. The moment made them bigger, I promise you.
But when you can do them in the moment, that's part of being great.
Well, the more you're in the moment, it makes you more comfortable with the moment.
Okay.
So
they
feed on each other. I promise you Steve Stricker and Jim Furyk would have been holing more of those pitch shots.
Yeah.
They were far better than Tiger at pitching the ball. Now, again, that goes back to what Tiger did this year. He chipped better this year than he's ever chipped in his life. So, again, along the lines of the greatest comeback I've ever seen.
Yeah, that was a big part of it.
Yes, that was a huge part of it.
But to limit it to Jack and Tiger, let's give Tiger a slight edge, and at least a slight edge.
And pitching short, the ball, short sure, game. Okay.
But, you know, I think there's a sense that, well, Tiger, you know, was longer and Tiger was more explosive, could make more birdies because, you know, he just had, you know, this dynamic element to his game that, and I think Jack probably was farther ahead of his competition in terms of power and accuracy combined, true power golf, than Tiger was.
No question.
And that, I think, gets lost sometimes. I mean, Arnold Palmer, remember talking to him about Jack, and he goes, you know, no one remembers how great an iron player Jack was. I mean, his greens and regulation thing stats were, they weren't as sophisticated as today, but they were just off the charts. And he just wouldn't miss a shot with a six. And that's an era when guys were hitting six and five and four irons, even Jack into par fours.
Yes.
So, and Jack was an incredible athlete growing up. So I'm not denigrating Tiger in any way. I just often wonder, because I think it's very, very close. And Tiger had some, I think, some advantages temperamentally, too, over Jack in terms of motivation and the amount of fire that he had in competition. He might have been even better competitor than Jack. It's possible. I know he hadn't come from behind, but when he got ahead, that was awesome.
Certainly with the lead.
So all I'm saying about Jack is great driver of the golf ball.
Best ever.
So there you go. So how much do you factor that in when you say, I mean, because you've only talked about, not only, but you've emphasized management. I just wonder if he gets his due as a physical player of skill and tools, so to speak.
You know, as you know, Jack is, you know, he's an elder statesman in the game, and he talks pretty humbly. Mm-hmm. When you hear him, he talks pretty humbly. You know, Tiger, you know, can still break my record, and you know, when people ask him about how great he was, he's been asked that, you know, umpteen million times.
Sure.
He sort of humbly dismisses it, and unless you're like us, constantly going back and looking at the footage of Jack Nicklaus when he was younger, it's easy to sort of see him later in his years because all that video is fresh and think, well, that's Jack. It doesn't look that amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But he had, you know, the first year they kept statistics on the PGA Tour of
it was like the IBM
1980. Okay. Well, in '68 they had IBM did them.
But as far as the tour.
In '68, you're right. You're well. And Jack led those in fairways and greens and regulation. Mm-hmm. But in '80, he was a 40-year-old man. And I, you know, now then they'll say, you know, total driving is, you know, an antiquated statistic, but it was the best they had in 1980. And I don't entirely agree it's antiquated, but in 1980 it was the best they had, which is a cumulative stat of driving distance and accuracy. And he set a record then that has not been surpassed since. It wasn't surpassed by David Duvall, it wasn't surpassed by Greg Norman, it wasn't surpassed by Tiger Woods, not even close. So you can only sort of extrapolate backwards from 1980 to sort of imagine how great of a driver Jack was in 1962, 3, 4, 5, 6, and even in the 70s when Jack had his most dominant period. So, you know, Jack had tremendous control. And this is my argument again about you know, what the game's missing now, in my opinion, is no longer is missing a fairway a penalty. The penalty for missing a fairway on the PGA Tour last year was 0.1%, 10% of a shot. And that to me is ludicrous. And just in and of itself, it's ludicrous. But the consequences philosophically about what that means to golf, it's egregious. That's egregious because it tells players that you don't have to be accountable for the hardest thing to do in golf, which is
straight.
To hit it straight. And long and straight is the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
And no longer is long and straight that important in the game of golf. Long and pretty straight is the new long and straight.
I totally agree with
which
you.
Which is, to me, it's just, it's egregious.
The
caretakers of the game are missing it.
Yes, I agree.
You have to have the
game's out of balance.
It's out of balance. And how do you, as the game's gotten, look, as players have gotten longer, and they've gotten, you know, we're on TV 24/7. We're constantly talking about these players. Their profile is enormous now. They're tremendously wealthy, and with that comes a little bit more gravitas, a little bit more power. And so the sense is that you have to listen to them and how you set up a golf course. And if you listen to the players and how to set up a golf course, you will make a mistake.
Yeah.
It'd be like asking your students what you want them to what questions you want on the test. You don't ask your students
this
what
is another
questions
segment.
On the test.
We're going to talk about this more in the future. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's my point. Is that Jack had the longest, he was the longest straightest driver in the history of the game. That's the hardest thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, you know, he hit long irons like nobody. And I would imagine that he was comparable to Tiger Woods in mm-hmm. his iron play.
Yeah.
And that's saying something, because I can't imagine there's ever been an iron player better than Jack or Tiger.
By the same token, you've said that Tiger was the most dominant player. So yes. What was the basis of that dominance? Was it his competition? Was it his skill level? What did he have in his game that Tiger, that Jack didn't have, that made him more dominant?
It was the competence all the way through the bag. You know, at his best, he wasn't as good as Jack was off of the tee, mm-hmm. but he was long and straight. You know, he hit 70, almost 73% of the fairways in 2000,
yeah.
and he was second in driving distance. And it's pretty easy to discount John Daly, because John was trying to hit it as hard as he could on every shot. Look, John Daly, I love his golf swing, I really do, and I love what he accomplished. But there was a carelessness and a recklessness to the way he played golf. Tiger Woods was second in driving distance and hit 73% of the fairways. So he was the best iron player by miles. He had a 10-yard advantage over third place in driving distance. 10 yards. Mm-hmm. Third place was Davis Love at 288. Tiger averaged 298 in 2000. So you're talking about a huge advantage over second place in driving distance. And he was arguably the greatest putter ever during that period. And, you know, I mean, there's nothing else beyond that. And, mm-hmm. and you know, from a golf IQ standpoint, you know, he was Einstein. You know, he was you know, off the charts.
So in your mind, that was there. Possible, sustainable, and he stopped sustaining because he
right.
experimented.
His craziest thing in the history of sport, not mm-hmm. golf, sport. Mm-hmm. This would be, you know, the 98 Bulls completely restructuring their team the very next year. This would be Michael Jordan changing the way he shoots, you know, jumpers or free throws. You know, I mean, basketball is not my bailiwick, but. You get the picture. He had what every athlete dreams of. I mean, you first dream of some form of consistency. Then you dream of some form of dominance. To have dominant consistency, and to not only have that, but have it in a way that nobody else had ever approached it. 142 cuts in a row, winning tournaments by 15 shots. Matter of fact, that event in 2000 was, there's only ever been three events in the history of professional golf with a fourth standard deviation that exceeded everything by four standard deviations. Two of them were by women, by the way. Christy Kerr had the greatest major ever played at the LPGA Championship. I believe it was 2011 when she won, or 2010 when she won by 12. And Yanni Sen the next year at the LPGA Championship. But Tiger's second. Mm-hmm. So he wins by 15. He wins by 8. He has the greatest season in the history of major championship golf. That's ladies or men. And then, you know, within a year and a half, 2 years, he fires Butch, and he wants to change his golf swing.
You know, that's hindsight, of course. And is it fair to expect him to have known that he had everything already? Isn't it human nature to think, especially when you're young?
What kind of evidence would he need?
His own belief and his own conception of himself, in that he saw flaws, he saw mistakes, he thought close to perfection was possible, and that's what he was seeking. It's what made him great in the first place in terms of going on that journey to that extent. He had the talent, but he also had the drive, and he knew enough about the golf swing in his mind to make the right decisions about it. I think what he didn't understand was, even if you make the right conceptual decision, it's still a different move. Your body has to adjust. It takes time. These are your prime years. You're losing time. And that's what I think history's taught us. But
I'd like to have been in the room when that conversation
took
place.
Is it fair to say that made him an underachiever? Because, he didn't achieve possibly, and this is speculative on your part, that if he just stayed with Butch, he would have gotten better and better. We don't know that either. We think, and it makes sense.
Time makes a player better until there's physiological decline such that...
Learn is the model is, take what you have, master it, keep it consistent and simple so it's as repetitive as possible, with the knowledge that nothing is ever perfectly repetitive, and there's plenty of variables day to day, no matter how screwed your swing seems. And
yes.
I think that's what Tiger, and I'm being presumptuous here, I think that's what he didn't understand.
Yeah.
Is that, you know what, even with his Butch swing or whatever swing that was winning by 15 and 12 and all those things, he still was never really in full control of that swing.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a, you know, look, we're speculating here a little bit, but I think it's a product of this generation that is easily bored. You know, it's a video game sort of mentality. I'm bored. I want to change this golf swing, and I'll prove to you that I can do it. I mean, it was a bit boredom, perhaps. It was a bit arrogant. It was a bit, I can do whatever I want.
There's also the factor that he was a prodigy and a boyhood prodigy, and those, certainly with child actors, and those guys tend to, or those people, tend to have issues with longevity because they burned so hot for so long from a young age that maybe, and now I'm really speculating, but, you know, was my childhood robbed from me? I want to do different things. I mean, Johnny Miller's talked about this. Yeah. By the time he was 30, he's, and I've talked to some old caddies, that when Johnny was 28, he wanted to do things that adolescents did. You know,
right?
Because he missed all that, and it.
Well, there's a bit of
not that he regretted it tremendously, but it was a hole there in a normal life.
I get it. There's a genius aspect to Johnny Miller, no question about it. And there's, you know, that's usually accompanied by, you know, some eccentricity, and I think Tiger had that. I mean, this quest to build and destroy was, you know, you could make a reasonable argument that it's what made him great. I mean, look, it produced. I could make an argument that swing he had in 96 was one of the best ever. Matter of fact, I will have out within a few years this book on the 100 greatest swings of all time. Mm-hmm. Tiger will be in the book three, perhaps four times. I mean, that's preposterous that he's got three or four different swings that were such quality that he will be in that book different. You know, it's ridiculous to think that somebody would ever have more than one swing. It takes a lifetime to build one swing. But the swing in 96 was amazing. But the swing that he had in 2000 produced the greatest golf ever. And, you know, I hear it all the time. Well, he snapped his left leg, and that's why he hurt his left leg. Well, you know, anybody that says that just needs to go on YouTube and see, look at Sam Snead, look at Gary Player. You can't find two players that play the game better, longer. You know, and I'm talking about into their 60s. Sam Snead finished third in the PGA when he was 62. He made the cut in the PGA when he was 67. Okay? So, and Gary Player was doing similar
feats of
unimaginable
longevity.
Things. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Both of them snapped their left leg harder or as hard than Tiger Woods. Snapping your left leg was not what injured Tiger. Likely stuff in the gym, likely jumping out of a helicopter. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't his golf swing.
You know, it's interesting about Jack because I think the conception is that he left more good golf out there, even himself. But I think, paradoxically, that's actually his genius. You know, I've asked him, and he said, you know, I probably got about 70% out of it in terms of my effort. There were years where I just did not grind. And it's famously when before his dad passed, right, and when his father passed, it sort of gave him this urgency that I didn't get the most out of it. But he also said, you know, I kept my juice as a result. And as we talk about management and longevity, we realize that Jack, either inadvertently or intuitively or perhaps consciously, actually was on the right path in terms of keeping it going for a long time.
You know, I admire Jack so much. You know, for the family, I had a pretty good, you know, opportunity to get to know Jackie Jr. and Gary and Nan, and just thought the world of them. Yeah. You know, and they're fabulous people. It's a fabulous. I mean, Barbara. I mean, we could do in a whole hour on what a, you know, what a
well,
saint
that,
she is, you know, Saint Barbara.
Brought some stability.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I have such admiration for not only Jack, what he did with his family, how he raised his family, but just the way he handled himself in general. You know, he was appropriate. You know, I don't think we'd call him gregarious, but he was appropriate. He was professional. He was respectful. And, you know, that's why I think Gary Player sort of, you know, wink, wink, elbow in the side, calls him the greatest loser ever because because he was the most gracious loser. By the way, he was the most gracious winner because, you know, I would say that the histrionics that Tiger goes through, they're wonderful to watch. Mm-hmm. They're fabulous to watch, and they're compelling, and they make you watch the screen, and we've got highlight shows of them, but they're not particularly respectful to the people he just
beat.
Well,
and I think the longevity, I think it was a healthier way to achieve competition and to handle loss and victory for Jack. And not Tiger. And so, not to criticize Tiger, but just to say, I think in retrospect, Jack was not devastated by many losses because he just had a healthy respect for his opponent. I think Watson chipping in 82 hurt him.
Yeah,
it took him a little while to get over that.
That was the fifth open.
Yeah. But, you know, again, his resilience was great.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, though. Let's say Tiger pulls a miracle and actually wins five more majors and passes Jack.
Yeah.
Now, we don't know what the statistics are going to say.
Right.
But
that's right.
So I would say, so what? I mean, I would say,
he met
the moment.
Sure.
He did the thing that's most dramatic and has the most impact.
Absolutely.
So would he then be the greatest player?
Well, likely, you know, again, and I would say 99% of the people in the world, that would do it hands down from an opinion standpoint. You can't argue he won the most majors, he won the most tournaments. What else do you need? And I would say, you know, I mean, I'm sure that his statistics would come up such that
they would
rival
but
Jack's.
But let's say they didn't.
Well, then I would say he's not. You know, look, I mean, we've come to the point where we no longer have to be prisoner of the moment. We all of the time attach attributes to people based upon athletic achievement that are not appropriate. You know, we attach, you know, we say that somebody's smart or we say that somebody's a great guy just because they've had huge athletic achievement. It's like, I'm not going to do that. I want to see the data. And if the data says, if the raw numbers say, because I'm of the opinion now, and again, I'm of the opinion now, every event you play in your career matters. You know, and if you miss more, you know, 20 cuts, and you win, you know, five times, whatever, those 20 cuts matter.
I understand, but doesn't winning take something special, and that element, it goes beyond the numbers, transcends the numbers. In other words, there's a psychological reality there that some people are wonderful at contending and may have the most consistent and better statistics by your standard. But when it came to winning, the special thing that history records and makes the biggest impression, not only on the fans but on the other players, they weren't that good at it.
Well, look.
So Jack was a good winner. Tiger was an incredible winner.
Yeah.
I know majors probably are skewed too far in the, you know, in the plus column, but it's hard to say when you're standing over a 6-footer for a major to win it, and you have the gumption and the wherewithal to make that putt. You're a greater golfer than the guy who might outplay you week in, week out, who won't make that putt.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, if you have the talent to be there, you're going to be there a lot more often than somebody less talented, which means you become more comfortable in those moments. And so it's a cumulative effect.
I think it's a learned behavior, not innate.
It's absolutely. It's, you know, I mean, very rarely, I mean, more and more often now, I will say that players are coming out more fully formed now than they ever have. And again, that's statistically represented as well. And we're in an era, I think, of unprecedented young talent, no question about it, unprecedented. And that's great to see. And I think that is the result of, and again, I'm coming full circle on this, I think coaching has improved. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, 24/7 golf helps young athletes understand what it takes to play the game at the highest level. But if you're talking about the probability or the likelihood, or if Tiger does X, will he then be greater than Jack? It's so unlikely that
it
would happen.
But I was looking at
the only way
that you're talking about,
he would have to be dominant, because it's not about. Exceptionality comes from dominance. It doesn't come from consistency. First, it comes from dominance. Mm-hmm. And he would have to display dominance such that that could even happen.
But for you, dominance is not necessarily excelling in majors and not playing well the rest of the year.
Well, if you're dominant, you're going to excel in major championships.
For example, was Brooks Koepka a dominant player last year?
Well, look, Brooks Koepka's and again, this is my issue with the way golf is going.
Mm-hmm.
Under certain circumstances, course conditions come together to where you cannot beat somebody who hits it 9 miles. Perfect circumstances arrived of a soft golf course and soft greens or 50-yard wide fairways. Again, this is my beef with the USGA. You know, the Whisper, you know, the Chambers Bay and the Aaron Hill, they're disasters. disasters.
On the other hand, I think
to have a fairway that wide allow the type of golf that's being played shuffle its way to the top.
I think Brooks somewhat, I say vindicated, but he gained credibility as a player by winning at Shinnecock because that was a fairly narrow golf course.
No.
Well, it was wider than
not U.S. Open narrow.
Classic U.S. Open narrow. He played well, and he was able to play from the.
Okay, I think he's a hell of a player.
I just think
that he doesn't have to. When you hit the ball, what's going on in golf right now is you do not have to go through the mental quandary. You don't have to achieve the same level of calmness on the tee with a penalty for a miss. You can drive with impunity.
We're going to talk about this.
And that's what drives me nuts, because it doesn't just affect the immediate outcome. It affects the type of player end up. Yeah. Look, I'd go to the gym too, because all that matters is how strong you are, not how calm you are.
Let's put this on the table, because we will talk about it later.
What's great about Jack. Jack stood up on a fairway where if you hit it 9 miles, obviously your dispersion rate gets wider, and the more likelihood that you're going to miss gets bigger, and the penalty you're going to suffer is even more prominent in your mind. And he had the calmness and the control and the quality to get up there and hit a high fade right in the middle of the fairway or the right side of the fairway, whichever had the best angle into the green. Mm-hmm. And he would do that.
I am in favor of that kind of golf, and I wish it would go back to that kind of golf, but it's hard to indict the current players. They're being asked to do – now, you're saying –
not indicting the current players.
No, I know. Well,
it's the system that's producing the golf.
And I agree with you. I think it is an inferior style. I think the game –
it's inferior.
I think the game is out of balance.
Yeah, it's out of
balance. But this is what – and maybe the players have shaped the conditions of the golf course and the setups, that's on the organizations. But I think the point is that they – are doing what's asked of by the golf course and what the equipment will allow them. And if Jack was playing today, he'd do the same thing probably. Like Phil was talking the other day, and not to get too far off the track, but Phil was saying at PGA West, I'm just going to hit it as hard as I can. I mean, it was just the bomb and gouge philosophy, writ large, basically. And Phil's a smart guy, and that's going to have an effect. It's like that's the percentage way. Mm-hmm. It seems counterintuitive that that's the percentage way to play because it's high risk, it would seem. But actually, it's the percentage way to play the tour.
Yeah, but it hurts you. I mean, look, there's a reason Phil played so poorly in the Ryder Cup.
It hurts
you on
certain
courses.
There's a reason
he decided to skip Farmers for the first time since 1990 because Phil can't drive it in the fairway with any degree of consistency.
But week to week on the PGA Tour, it's a consistent way to play. Let me just add really quickly. I would say, I respect the whole truth. I don't understand the numbers like you do. I know that it's good that golf is going in that direction to quantify things in a way that's beyond the eye test. I would say, though, I think as a lifelong sports fan, and I know you are too, winning time, so to speak, is what separates champions the most. Why is Tom Brady is not, in many ways, the greatest quarterback statistically.
Right.
But in the Super Bowl, in these playoff games, he does something special. At the moment, it has to be done. Most people's mind, makes him the greatest player. I think Tiger had that quality. And I think statistics back it up with the third-round lead and the way he converted at that rate.
No question.
And Jack was great at it, but Tiger was superior. To me, that's Tiger's greatest argument for being the greatest player. That and when he was in position, he could handle all the psychological burdens and the variables of golf, where you don't have your game every day, and he still brought it home all the time. That was amazing.
His 36 hole closure rate, his 54 hole closure rate are some of the greatest statistics in golf. And look, he's clearly the best player that's ever played in his peak years. And I'm not saying this book dismisses all opinion, because then what fun would that be? We no longer get to debate.
The discussion is what advances the truth.
As I said at the beginning of the show, I think you take your opinions out, you kick them around and see if you still believe them. And, until something comes along that convinces me otherwise, I think in this era of big data, when we can accurately measure, and look, I mean, prior to 1920, things don't pan out perfectly in a bell curve. So because of that, the standard deviation doesn't quite work. It's not quite as precise. So you can't say prior to 1920 the proper ranking of those players. But since then, it was some pretty degree of accuracy you can. So I'm a big believer in it. But I'm perfectly happy to sit around here and listen to arguments that Jack's, sure, you know, Tiger's better than Jack over the course of his career, mm-hmm, because of his 54-hole closure rate. It's a compelling argument, and you know it's better than Jack's was, but we'll see. You know,
I just say it's Tiger's best argument. Not that he's making the argument, but it puts him closer to Jack in my mind. I still think Jack was the best.
I think that's well said. You know, I haven't had that many people present that argument.
What I wanted to ask you though is, has Tiger fallen because of the what you've learned in your mind? Is he even the second greatest golfer?
No, he's not.
By that book, but yeah. I mean, are you really?
What you do is you go back and you look a little deeper. So let's make a case for Walter Hagen, okay? From 1913 to 1929, Walter Hagen played in 31 major championships. As we know them, major championships. He won 11 of them. So we're talking roughly a third of them. But back then, the Western Open was a major championship, okay? But they didn't have the terms that we use now. Yeah. The terms, nomenclature evolves and it devolves, okay? Mm-hmm. So we've evolved now into calling majors, you know, big tournaments majors. The Masters came along and it's evolved into a major championship. Sure. But as that happened, the Western devolved, mm-hmm, from major status.
Hagen lost
but
those. Yeah.
We are no more right to rob Walter Hagen of his 5 Western Opens than we are to give Gene Harrison the Grand Slam for winning the 1935 match. He didn't win a major when he held that way. He won a golf tournament.
Yeah.
He won a gathering. He won the Hero.
He got the major.
He won the equivalent of the Hero Challenge in 1935.
I think
it was not the shot heard around the world. So when you start to look, when you start to look at what Walter Hagen did, so he won 11 major championships. No, he didn't. He won 16. That's 2 more than Tiger. Okay, and then you start to look at what Sam Snead did and see the longevity and the greatness. You know, Sam didn't play in the Open Championship. He played in it in 1937, his rookie year. He finished 11th. He didn't play in it again until 1946, and he won it. Then he didn't play again until 1962 when he was 50, and he finished 6th. He only played 4 times. So you start to look at Sam Snead's record, and again, his career Z-score, standard deviation, It is superior to Tiger's. Mm-hmm. So Walter Hagen, Sam Snead, Jack Nicklaus, their career scores, mm-hmm, were better than Tiger's. Tiger can still change that. He's 43. We, mm-hmm, just saw. He could change that. He could come back. And he was on a trajectory to be the greatest player ever. But look, bad tournaments, bad decades, bad decisions, mm-hmm, whatever you want to say, they have a cost.
Yeah.
And they've cost him in the career ranking.
Very quickly, I'll just counter on Hagen, not to say it's definitive, but he never beat Jones in a major beyond when Jones was starting to win majors. So that was always sort of like, well, Jones was actually better than Hagen. And then
well, that's just the U.S. Open.
Well, I get. Well, there were a couple of. Yeah, that's true.
I mean,
and British Open, too.
I don't know that they played in the same Open. Mm-hmm. It was like when Hagen would go, Jones wouldn't go.
Yeah, I don't want to put too much on
Hagen
that.
Hagen won it in 29. He didn't even play in 30.
Yeah, and you know, Hagen won the match, the 72-hole match they had, pretty handily.
Right. Whatever. So it's a pretty small data.
Yeah, it's a small data. I agree. And Snead, you know, unfortunately just didn't close in majors where he was in contention as often as Hogan did or even Nelson. So I think in many people's eyes, not to say they're right, that factor puts him down a little bit. I still think Randall, and I hope the eye test doesn't go away.
Yeah. So look, Snead won 5 tournaments or more, 8 times in his career. 8 times in 1950, he won 11.
You know,
tournaments.
As far as being a golfing machine and a golfing athlete, I don't think anybody was ever better than Snead. From what I, from talking to guys like Toski and guys who played with him a lot. Yeah. He could do things even that Nelson couldn't do. Nelson was the underrated guy because he had such a short career. But as far as controlling the ball and hitting it where he was looking.
Right. I mean, the record, Tiger's chasing Snead.
All I would say is I hope the eye test doesn't go away.
No, I don't think it ever will.
Well, what does it mean to you? You've seen so much golf. You've studied so much golf. You know so much about golf. And you watch.
So the eye test doesn't go away. I get that. And, mm-hmm, and we all want to argue for what's most recent and give it originality. But that dismisses, and all I'm saying is, I don't want to dismiss.
I agree.
Because when you say greatest of all time, anytime I'm on a panel and people say, I'm like, well, are we going to really consider players?
I think you're
or not.
I think your criteria right now is a more noble and equal way of judging everybody.
That's right.
And when you say, I don't disagree with it.
And when you say greatest player of all time,
but it's almost
I don't mean men.
I know.
Men
yeah.
or women. It's gender.
It's almost like
too.
Sabermetrics and analytics in baseball.
That's right.
Obviously, the general managers are using that to a greater extent. But there was a moment during Moneyball, for example, where analytics took over too much, and guys were starting to make bad decisions because they had neglected the eye test of maybe the older scouts and anecdotal things that I still hope that the human, you know, intuition and the human sense of that's better than that will still matter.
They use statistics. All right, let's just say, when you first start using Sabermetrics, right? Mm-hmm. Oakland A's, Moneyball, famous, right?
Yeah.
All right, so with far less salary, he puts together this ragtag team, does really well. Okay, it's a huge advantage when you're the one doing it, okay? Mm-hmm. You're the one, the only one at the table counting cards. But when everybody starts counting cards, mm-hmm. when everybody does it, then nuance becomes more of a factor.
Yes.
That one scene where they're sitting there and they're talking, he's got the old scouts in there, and one's saying, well, he's got an ugly girlfriend. And they're like, well, what does that have to do with it? Ugly girlfriend means he's got no confidence.
It's a variable,
And he's like, you guys are missing the boat,
That's a Me Too moment
We're card counters, okay? Yeah. We're going to flip the game upside down.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, Brad Pitt's character was going, we're not talking about opinion anymore. We're talking about fact. And we have at our disposal the ability to
look at the facts.
But are
those statistics definitive? In other words, the whole truth's a wonderful first step, perhaps, only.
Yeah.
They're going to refine these stats.
Yeah.
Should you buy all in on something that, in essence, is a pioneering
effort? Well,
it's a pioneering effort. It's not a definitive effort.
There's plenty of people that will say, you know, the Western Open wasn't a major. But, look, in my eyes, it was. I've always looked at it as, I don't think it's right that we've taken majors away from players, given majors to players. You know, nobody can pinpoint exactly. I mean, who's a better historian than you?
No,
I mean,
you tell me. No, I'm not.
You're right there. Who would be Norm Nelson?
No, I know things.
Can you tell me exactly
I'm
when
not,
the Masters
I'm not comprehensive.
Major?
I'm not
right,
comprehensive.
Nobody can.
Well,
I mean,
there's a lot of people who know more about
the
facts.
Right, I mean, if Dan Jacobs were sitting right here.
I trust, and I'm not saying, I'm just one opinion here, but I do trust the sense of assessing athleticism and assessing, skill. And that may not be borne out all the time by statistics. And so maybe I'm wrong with that.
Well,
but I think, you know, when you talk about the eras of golf, you look at Byron Nelson's swing, and you look at Sam Snead's swing, and you look at Ben Hogan's swing, and has the game really progressed? Are golfers really better?
That's a great point.
You know, so
everybody now still talking about those golf swings.
Okay, and those are three that are the most obvious. But you know, you wonder with equipment becoming what it has, and the course setups being what they are, has the game been de-skilled?
Which, well, it's been de-skilled, but the golf swing has gotten worse
in a lot
of aspects.
Yeah. I don't mean to get off Tiger and Jack, because the point, I think, is Jack's era is something that hasn't been considered as well either. I mean, Tiger, there's a presumption that he beat more players, there was more depth. But there's also the argument that Jack beat more hardened winners.
Right.
And it was at the top of the leaderboard harder to win in those days. So.
Yeah.
This could go on forever.
Yeah,
Kaz,
but those,
how are we
those,
doing?
Those arguments. Those,
1 minute?
Those.
Okay.
We got 1 minute. But, you know, just real quickly on that point.
Sure, yeah.
You can, regardless of the era, you're a product of whatever era you grew up in. So if your era is less athletic than a previous era, the likelihood that you would dominate athletically is just as impressive as somebody who dominates
just very quickly,
in an
though, every sport that's measured with time is more athletic.
Of course, look, if Francesco Molinari went back and played Bobby Jones, he would demolish him.
Okay.
He would demolish him. He would beat him,
but not
if 9-8.
Not necessarily if Bobby Jones had the same equipment and could practice with it.
Well, I'm just talking about
Molinari
better than Bobby Jones? No, not even in the same league.
Yeah.
But he would demolish him if they played head-to-head.
Well, I think this is a view that people have about Tiger and Jack.
So
in other words, the game
has
progressed. Tiger won at an area when the game had progressed farther, so he's better than Jack. In that regard, because all the golfers are better.
You have to compare, and you shouldn't, because you have to compare what someone did against their peers, mm-hmm. and then you use that comparison to another athlete in another area compared to their peers, and then you use that comparison to another athlete what they did against their peers, and then you can draw.
Yeah.
Look, you can make comparisons across eras and across genders. I am not at all in the camp that you can't start talking about Annika Sorenstam is the second greatest player of all time. Patty Berg is the fourth best player of all time. Because, again, standard deviation, Z-score, it is gender neutral, it is era neutral, and only then can we start to go back and appropriately bring the careers into perspective of the greatest players of all time.
Apples and oranges, men to women, personally. I give you that some were more dominant than others, but the ball's going 60 yards farther with the men. So
Francisco Molinar hits it 60 yards further than Bobby Jones did. So is that apples to oranges?
Well, that's...
Is that apples to oranges?
That's an interesting point.
I mean, with different equipment, though. With the same equipment, but he would hit it further.
No, I don't think. I think if Jones had today's equipment, he wouldn't be 60 yards behind Francisco.
Well, you're right, with different equipment. But regardless, the quality of golf that Molinari is playing in this era far surpasses the quality of golf that Bobby Jones was playing in his era.
But Bobby Jones's level, or Bobby Jones, is the game he played may have required more skill because of the equipment. So that's where I think the issue is. What era had the most skill?
Right.
But let me just conclude then, because we've run out of time and it's been great.
Right. Kaz is telling us we've had enough time.
Yeah, we had enough
time. We'll have to save this for the next podcast.
Well, of course. So just on the Tiger, I guess where we are is actually Tiger has fallen slightly from your earlier view that he was closer to Jack. And for me, he's still very close to Jack. There was a time I thought he was going to be better than Jack.
Me too.
And I assumed it. And
me too.
And it depends again on the criteria. If you say, well, was the best golf he played better than Jack's best golf, then perhaps he is the greatest golfer. But if it's the totality and the career, then I think Jack's ahead.
But he's got this.
I think it's still the jury's out until Tiger's career is over.
He's got that freight train of history is back on the tracks, and there's never been a more compelling golfer in the history of the game than Tiger Woods. Never, not even close. I mean, everything he does is he's animated. You know, his life narrative, that scene
at East Lake, that was basically reflective of people connecting with an incredible human story that we haven't seen probably other than Hogan.
People love a great comeback story.
Yeah,
and so much complexity
and so much nuance to it too, because from childhood all through adulthood, his life's been complicated and not easy. And I think people sense that.
He was noticeably different last year.
Yeah.
Not just on the golf course, but just in every way he reacted with the media. I thought he was, you know, very respectful. He got asked, you know, difficult questions and the same question every single day. He was respectful. He was patient.
He's compartmentalized.
It was great to see.
The killer that it took to be.
Yeah, it was great.
The winner
see.
That he was.
Great
and,
to see.
And grown as a human.
Yeah. It was very easy to be pulling for him last year. You know, we're meant to be, you know, impartial, but it was very easy to pull for him.
Well, great talking to you.
All right, enjoy.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jaime.
Thank you, Kaz.
Look forward to doing this.
And so we'll be seeing you guys in a month. And we don't know what the topic's going to be, but I know it'll be profound coming from Brandel, and hopefully
whatever piques our interest,
we'll break some new ground in golf thinking. Thank you very much.
Bring on spring projects with Spring Black Friday Savings from The Home Depot. With free delivery on over 2 million items, you can bring on the spring cleaning, the patio decorating, and the front yard gardening. And if you need it fast, get same-day delivery on thousands of products like fertilizer and seeds to keep your yard looking beautiful. Bring on the spring doing and spring your way only at The Home Depot. How doers get more done. Order select in-stock items by 4 p.m. subject to availability.